Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. We have a very interesting discussion. I just attended a conference in Aspen, Colorado, on cryptocurrencies. And I was very lucky because Harry Blaser decided to join me at the conference. And it's one thing to face evil presented as good and in an umbrella of complexity. It's always hard to do it alone. I've gotten used to doing it. But to have Harry there and help me unpack what was going on and what it means to you and me was absolutely wonderful. We are in the middle of a fever, if you will, a pump and dump. We're in the pump part of the pump. And whether it was the internet tech bubble, the housing bubble, the bailouts, the missing, I've lived through these bubbles before, and I've seen an enormous number of people get caught up in them and sort of lose their place and end up being much worse off in terms of both financials and freedoms. And so watching this take off has been very frustrating, and having Harry there helping me figure it out and unpack it was really just an incredible blessing. So he agreed that he would join me and to give a complete report on what we've learned and step back and take the long view on Bitcoin. I wanted to call it Bitcoin, the most sophisticated op yet. Harry persuaded me to shorten it, Bitcoin the op. So we're going to be talking about blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies, including Bitcoin, reporting on what we learned in Aspen, and then talk a little bit about how this fits into the bigger geopolitical and governance and financial picture. So with that, Harry, welcome to the Soleri Report.
Thank you. A pleasure. And of course, one of the reasons I went to Nexus conference in Aspen was because you were there as a speaker and you actually got paid to be there. And to me, right. you added some of the most important value there, and perhaps even took some of the fog away from some of the younger folks there, that were being seduced. And you were able to create some cognitive dissonance that I think would be very useful to their development.
Well, there were some wonderful, I should mention, there were some really wonderful people there. There was Ed Griffin was there, Ron Paul was there, Dennis Kucinich was there, Patrick Byrne was there, Jesse Ventura was there. I finally got to meet Stacey Herbert, who's with Max Kaiser's sort of co-host. So there were a lot of interesting people there, and it was almost as though, you know, the cryptocurrency guys were doing opposition research.
Well, we both came to the conclusion that there's a lot of prototyping going on for different reasons, which we'll get into later.
Well, and I thought the young people were wonderful. And if you could communicate them, one of the books I kept bringing up and trying to get everybody to read was The Master Switch by Tim Wu, which describes, the subtitle is The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. And what it describes is, you know, I think it starts with the telegraph and it goes to the radio, TV, telephone. It describes the new technology coming out. And then there's this wonderful blossoming of innovation. It's very exciting. Young people, entrepreneurs get a hold of it, think they're going to save the world. And then after it sort of gets figured out, wham, it centralizes under tight central control. And it has the impact of further centralizing both politics and economy.
And I think that's an absolutely critical perspective, right. And I think it's absolutely in play when it comes to cryptocurrencies.
Right, and it's very important for the economics of it, and if you look at how the governance structure is run, that you get as many people and as many smart people as possible innovating, testing, trying, and so. You have this prototype phase, and the richer you can make your prototype phase, the better. And what I always say is the way they get the prototype phase to be rich is you make sure everybody's making money prototyping. And so, you know, what you do is we have price suppressed and manipulated all over the economy, but here you pump it, and the more you pump the price, the more you attract people coming in and figuring out how to prototype.
Well, To that end, you know, the guys that did the original so-called mining of bitcoins, you know, for pennies to begin with, and now the price today, I think it's what, 4,300? You know, that's 400,000 time return on your money and efforts. You know, that's a historically unprecedented, but not only that, unimaginable. So you talk about a pump. It's a pump of exponential dimensions compared to anything else ever.
Well, I want to mention the first bubble I lived through. The first bubble I lived through was in the 80s when the Fed was really pumping, you know, was really expanding the monetary supply. And I had a wonderful partner named Peter Flanagan. I talked about this at my speech at Nexus. And he would always fight with the traders and the guys in capital markets at bonus time. And he did an analysis once and said, okay, if we just ran the same average balances that we had during the, you know, during this last decade, and instead of having traders in the chairs, we had just run those average balances with chimpanzees, we would have made more money. Now, the reason I mention that is if you were hanging out with the people who made, you know, who were sitting in those chairs during that period, they all thought they were geniuses. I mean, that I've never seen arrogance and hubris like that until, of course, the, you know, the housing bubble. But one of the things that happens that I've seen is literally when you pour significant money into somebody's pocket, particularly who's never had it before, it affirms them beyond their wildest imagination, and they literally lose their mind and they don't know it.
I agree.
Right.
Now, and, go ahead.
So you and I have seen this many, many times. And you know, but this is the first time we're seeing it to this extent. We're watching people disappear into the virtual world. There was a lot of discussion there, and we'll discuss it later about, you know, I kept saying, look, the governance system and control is analog, not digital. And one of my favorite moments at the conference was when one group was arguing about Bitcoin and gold, and you said, what about seed? So, you know, I had this image when you said it of all these people fighting over, you know, cryptocurrencies while their soil is slowly being poisoned away, and they don't even notice.
Well, you were also the one that mentioned that this is a distraction,
right,
in terms of time, effort, you know, attention, you name it, but also because of resources, because if you're putting your money here, you ain't putting it in other places.
Right, and my fear is not money. My fear is time. If you put your time here, you're not putting it in other places. And that's, you know, I think we need to think in terms of time and attention. But I'm getting ahead. I do want to mention one thing. Before I went to the conference, I spent many, many weeks, because my clients have been asking me about this, and I really felt I needed to unpack it. And I spent over 100 hours, much of it with a wonderful ally named Court Skinner, doing due diligence. And two things happened, Harry. One is, you know, I felt like I really had a beat on it before I got there, but I learned a lot more, and a lot confirmed what I'd come to the conclusion with Court. But historically, as whether an investment bank or an investment advisor, my take on things is if I can't understand it after 100 hours of serious due diligence, there's a problem. And it's not me. That's number one. But I can't tell you how many times, you know, informed ignorance is used, oh, well, it's your problem, you don't understand it. You know, it's used as a marketing mechanism to shame the person who can't understand it. And to me, that's a number one red flag. But the other red flag is, you know, if you can't understand it, the people marketing start to bully. Rather than educate you, they bully. And I've had a couple of experiences where people enthusiastic about the software industry tried to bully me into signing up for Ethereum or, you know, doing something with Bitcoin. And rather than answer my legitimate questions to make sure I had intellectual mastery of what was going, they just tried to bully me. And
I would say also there's two techniques. Bullying, which we saw certainly in certain some of the seminars and discussion groups that happened at the Nexus Conference. But there's also seduction. And when here we are presenting this, being presented to us by the marketing folks as something that's basically going to bring the Federal Reserve down, you know, allow for total decentralization of finances around the world, democratization, it's incorruptible, we get rid of all middlemen, it's incredibly efficient, astonishingly cheap, anonymous and totally confidential, unbelievably safe. And what we found out is that basically all those claims are false.
Right.
And that's right. Some of the things we're going to go into. So, you know, you have a lot of young folks that feel this is the way that we're going to bring humanity to another level of consciousness. And, you know, that's why we started to call this thing an op. Because it's something.
It's just something
intentional about it. It's just too, it's too slick. It's too refined. It's too well thought out. And it's too well marketed.
Well, here's what I will say. If you look at the people who, you know, and if you look at how they're running the op, it's dynamic. You know, they put it out and they grow it organically. But if you look at what they've done and how they're managing it, this is the smartest, cleverest one yet. It's even smarter, clever than the housing bubble.
So, and of course you've got good people in it too that are there with good intentions and want to see
right.
good things that are. So there's always that.
Right. And there are market fundamentals that are driving part of the desire for, you know, these kinds of solutions. So we'll talk about that. But first, before we do, let's just go through again and define what is Bitcoin, what is cryptocurrencies, what is blockchain.
Because
blockchain, Bitcoin is one cryptocurrency, but all cryptocurrencies are working with open database ledger software, and it's a fact, I think, that open ledger database software has a lot of potential. So let's just start with some definitions here. So why don't you walk us through?
Okay, so basically I came into this thing, I went to the Nexus Conference. By the way, I thought it was like Nexus Magazine that was sponsoring it, but no, it's Nexus Earth, which is basically its own cryptocurrency that's started by Colin Cantrell, who I think did a very effective job as an insider, you might say, of representing the limitations and shortcomings and dangers of Bitcoin. And Nexus was basically started to take care of those shortcomings and come up with something that actually could work as a currency, because Bitcoin can't right now for a number of reasons. So I just, you know, I didn't know hardly anything about it. I went to this conference to find out about it, but then also once we decided to do this talk, I said, well, I've got to really, you know, understand it even to a different level. So I prepared a fair amount of stuff. I'm going to go through it and jump in anytime, and hopefully this will be helpful, because I feel it will be helpful to me. So what is Bitcoin? It's the most popular cryptocurrency and the first commercial implementation of a cryptocurrency. Well, what's a cryptocurrency or crypto coin? It's a form of digital currency virtual that is produced by solving mathematical problems based on cryptography. It is, in essence, a chain of digital signatures. What's cryptography? Well, it's basically the science of figuring out how to keep secrets, you know, and using mathematics. And, what's a blockchain? Well, blockchain's a network of distributed databases used to maintain an immutable public ledger of transactions. It represents a record of all validated transactions grouped into blocks, each cryptographically linked to predecessor transactions down to the genesis block, thereby creating a chain of blocks. Bitcoin represents the first commercial use of the blockchain. So what are the origins of the blockchain-based Bitcoin? Well, Bitcoin is the first implementation of a concept called cryptocurrency, which was first described in 1998 by Weidai, on the cypherpunks mailing list, suggesting the idea of a new form of money that uses cryptography to control its creation and transactions rather than a central authority. The first Bitcoin specification and proof of concept was published by Satoshi Nakamoto and used the blockchain. Okay, so who is Satoshi Nakamoto? Well, we don't know. But we know that the name is a pseudonym for the inventor of the Bitcoin protocol, and which was basically published in a paper called Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system, which was made public via the cryptography mailing list in November 2008. This person or entity or group of
Can
persons...
Can I just point out one thing, Harry?
Sure.
It was published 2 months after the Lehman went down.
Ah, see,
okay.
you always add, always add very significant little facts. This person or entity or group of persons then released the first version of the Bitcoin software client in 2009 and participated with others on the project via mailing lists until he, she, they, or it faded away in the end of 2010. This entity was a member of the team that created an open source code that runs the Bitcoin network, but never revealed anything personal about it. Itself. The last anyone heard from Satoshi was in 2011 when this entity said he had moved on to other things. Some estimate that he might have mined what is now billions worth of bitcoins before departing. According to the bitcoingroup.com.au, which I'll reference among other things in our notes, Satoshi means clear thinking, quick-witted, wise. Naka can mean medium, inside, or relationship. Moto can mean origin or foundation. So things that could apply to a person who founded a movement by designing a clever algorithm, which he did. But then we met somebody at the Nexus conference who was of Japanese descent and fluent in Japanese, who also interpreted the name this way. Regarding the direct translation of Satoshi Nakamoto, the Japanese language is full of homophones, you know, things that sound like each other, so you can interpret different ways. So Satoshi Nakamoto can be written in several different ways. However, the most common way would be like this, and then he gives us some Japanese symbols. In Japanese, the surname is written and spoken before the first name. So breaking it down, Nakamoto, there's two symbols. One stands for center or central. The other is origin, root, and basis. And Satoshi stands for knowledgeable, intelligent, intelligence. So he says, so putting them all together, Satoshi Nakamoto, or in effect Nakamoto Satoshi, translate to the origins or roots are center intelligent, or can be understood as originating inside central intelligence. I hope this all makes sense, this guy says. If you believe that the powers that be like to hide their actions and intentions in plain sight, then this name certainly is quite interesting. So I want to look at this Satoshi paper because it's basically 8 pages. It's mostly readable. It's in English. There's a little bit of math at the end. But first, before we do that, I just want to talk about a few terms that you always hear in regard to Bitcoin. So one is called a hash, which is an algorithm. It's basically a math function. A function was described to me as a black box that has an input, and then you get an output out of it after it gets churned inside, which turns random-sized data into a string of numbers of a fixed size, which basically is a signature, designed to be irreversible, which means basically it's not feasible to revert it. And according to Wikipedia, the ideal cryptographic hash function has 5 main properties. It's deterministic, so the same message always results in the same hash. It's quick to compute. It is infeasible to generate a message from its hash value except by trying all possible messages. So, a small change to a message should change the hash value so extensively that the new hash value appears uncorrelated with the old hash value, and it's infeasible to find 2 different messages with the same hash value. There's also this thing called hash rate. That's the number of calculations that your hardware can perform every second. This becomes increasingly important because basically Bitcoin was set up to become increasingly more difficult to hash, to compute, as more and more Bitcoins were mined and the thing got bigger and bigger. This was intentional. So now, whereas you could basically use your computer, your CPU of your computer to do hashes when it first started, then not too long afterwards you needed GPU cards, the graphic cards that do gaming. You know, it's interesting how much of gaming and cryptology is involved with this whole thing. Right. And then you needed these things called FPGA, field programmable gate arrays, which are basically integrated circuits designed to be configured after they're built so that you can customize them for Bitcoin mining. But now what you need is basically ASIC, an application specific integrated circuit, which is a silicon chip specifically designed to do a specific task, which in this case is to process the SHA-256 hashing problems. That's the code that they use for Bitcoin mining. So if you don't have that, not only that, don't have a gigantic array of this stuff, you have no hope of being able to mine today. So there is an illusion out there that, you know, an individual can start mining these Bitcoins. And that's absolutely false.
Well, if you look at the ownership of Bitcoin, it's very concentrated. And one of the reasons
it's very concentrated is
if you look at what it takes to be a successful miner today, you know, it takes quite a investment of machinery and electricity, et cetera.
Huge. So right. It's going from mega hashes per second to giga hashes per second to now tera hashes per second. You know, that's how they measure the hash rate. There's also this concept of a node, which is a computer or a series of computers connected to the Bitcoin network that relays transactions to others. There's also this concept of a nonce. It's this arbitrary number used only once in a cryptographic communication. Many nonces also include a timestamp. And nonces are used to actually make it more complicated, make the mining process more complicated. And we'll have references for all these in our notes. Mining. The act of generating new Bitcoins by solving complex cryptographic puzzles using computing hardware. But a key to this, I've discovered, is those cryptographic problems are in essence verifying and confirming transactions in the Bitcoin network, which is equivalent to finding valid blocks and securing the global record of all the transactions, which is the blockchain. So miners are getting rewarded in two ways for making the network work. Through Bitcoins and through fees for validating transactions and maintaining the blockchain.
Let me just mention one thing. Bitcoin is set up so that it stops generating new Bitcoins at 21, I think it's 21 million. And
that's right.
The issue is, at that point, running the nodes on the blockchain is very expensive. So in theory, if they can't make money mining, then they have to make money by fees that generate enough money to run the nodes.
That point has actually almost arrived, well before the 21 million mark. So a fair amount of the income now is from fees, you know, by basically supplying services.
Well, right, but it's driving. If they generate enough fees to cover the electricity by splitting. You know, so splitting Bitcoins down into smaller and smaller points, you can do that, but it starts to get very expensive because there's so much redundancy in affirming the blockchain. And so this has embedded implosion potentially, depending on what the fees are.
Well, it's embedded centralization for sure. And
right.
We're seeing it in many, many flavors. But I guess the main thing I want to tell you about mining is it's not mining for Bitcoins. Bitcoins is the reward you get for mining for valid blocks. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for these blocks that they need that they can verify and validate using advanced mathematics, you know, that have already been prescribed, and using a lot of hardware because this stuff is becoming more and more difficult to do on purpose.
Right.
Okay, so that's it. It's not, and you get the Bitcoins because you have basically solved the problem and validated a block. Here's your reward. Now, that also represents a transaction that's happening. So the other way you get rewarded is here's your fee for basically allowing the transaction to happen. But now, as it becomes more and more difficult, as we'll see, well, it takes a lot more time. So there's a big backlog. So sometimes people have to wait a day for their transactions to actually be cleared.
Right.
Proof of work. They talk about proof of work. It's basically a hash block that is confirmed by the network is valid. There's also this concept of the 51% attack, which is now becoming very relevant because, as we find out, there's like seven people that basically control almost all the mining.
Right.
Well, when you say people, entities.
Yeah, so the market share of mining and the market share of ownership is highly centralized.
Right, and getting more so.
Right.
So the 51% attack is a condition in which more than half the computing power on a cryptocurrency network is controlled by a single miner or group of miners. That amount of power theoretically makes them the authority on the network. This means that every client on the network believes the attacker's hash transaction block. This gives them control over the network, including the power to issue a transaction that conflicts with someone else's, stop someone else's transaction from being confirmed, spend the same coins multiple times, which was never supposed to happen, of course, and prevent other miners from mining valid blocks. You talk about centralization and potential for fraud.
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, we have central banks. They have to turn their profits over to the sovereign government, and they have transparency. Is it perfect? No. But if you compare it to, you know, now we go to new central banks who have no transparency, are anonymous, and report to no one and keep their profits.
Yeah, and what's ironic is that the confidentiality that the user thought that they had, because they have to use wallets, they've got to use other services that are out there to exchange money, exchanges and payment services and so on. You've lost, or an ATM. You know, you've lost all confidentiality, all anonymity as soon as you start to use this damn stuff or convert it to something else. And, you know, another thing which is always ironic, these guys, you know, they have tremendous analogies in everything that they're doing to gold, even though they criticize gold as being an anachronism. You know, the Bitcoin is... it looks like a Krugerrand. It's the same color of gold. You know, they use analogies to mining and all this other stuff. So I find that incredibly ironic. Let me just go on here. There's another thought there, but it'll come out. So this Satoshi essay. The vision is non-intermediated peer-to-peer transactions of any size done electronically over the net, so transactions can occur anywhere, anytime, that are more efficient and cost-effective than bank-mediated transactions using purely digital currency for payments that are non-reversible and structured so trust is superfluous. That's basically the vision outlined in Satoshi's paper. And he tried to solve for two primary problems that have in the past required mediation of a trusted third party. Double spend, where the same piece of currency or Bitcoin is used twice to make a purchase, and reversibility of a transaction by a customer. So figuring out ways to not pay for something that has been acquired. So, you know, rather than go into detail about his paper, what I like to do at this point is kind of summarize the features of Bitcoin as it evolved in its present state. So, one, there's a public record of all transactions supposedly through the blockchain, which theoretically cannot be tied to an individual, that are confirmed as valid through consensus by a majority of nodes, but which in turn increases overhead and transaction time as the Bitcoin network grows. This has been compared to a glass safety deposit box where everyone can see that there is something in the box, but a specific user is the only one with the key to get in. Okay, there's timestamps for all transactions, which opens up the possibility for other uses of the blockchain technology that you were referring to that actually could be potentially quite useful. We can talk about them more later. Three, the need for wallets, exchanges, payment sectors, basically a whole superstructure of third-party financial service providers, you know, something that Bitcoin was supposed to make superfluous, where anonymity can no longer exist while opening up many more opportunities for hacking and fraud. Four, the Bitcoin wallet consists of two keys, the public key, which is your wallet address and is how other people send Bitcoins to you, and the private key, which enables you to send Bitcoins to other people. The combination of the recipient's public key and your private key is what makes cryptocurrency transactions possible. But if anyone else acquires the private key to your wallet, they can withdraw your funds, and because it's irreversible, you'll never see them again. So if you keep your coins in either an online wallet or a hard drive-based software wallet, you are vulnerable to attacks by hackers or malware that can log your keystrokes. You've talked about this in the past. So now they've come up with this whole array of wallets, and even people are telling you, hey, you really should keep your key on paper, you know, in a safe deposit box. You know, so this was supposed to eliminate all paper.
If you look at the security issues.
This was supposed to eliminate all paper, and here we are, back to paper.
Right.
Keep going.
So if you look at the, when I was doing the due diligence, what I realized is the only way that I could own Bitcoin was to keep it offline in a hardware wallet, including a hardware wallet that's got a screen. So, you know, the one I was looking at was $200+, $200 to $300. But that there was no secure way to do the transaction. So if I took my hardware wallet and I put it online and tried to do the transaction, that's where the security issues still skyrocketed. And because it's so complicated to do that, a lot of people do use the online wallets and the exchanges where they're leaving their private key with the service provider, which means it can be emptied out overnight. And we've seen that repeatedly. So, one, if you have it on your phone, that's not secure. If you have it on an exchange and the exchange get hacked or taken down, you can kiss your money goodbye. And if you, here's what's so interesting, because one of the links that I put up as the recommended links for Bitcoin was the Cambridge University study that walks you through all the different service providers. And it's the one that pointed out 72% of Bitcoin owners have their private key on the exchange or in the wallet, which, you know, is, I mean, that's like putting your cash on your front porch. So,
yeah, it's like including your PIN number on your on the little place where you make your signature on the back of your credit card.
Right. So one of the things that you know, I went through the standard both risk issues and security protections of secure you know, that apply to the securities industry. So if you look at the rules related to custodians, how custodians are organized and managed, or marketing, how risk issues are defined and disclosed. You know, if you look at every service provider I've seen, every wallet provider I've seen, every promoter of cryptocurrencies I've seen, if they were held to those standards, they would all be not approved for prime time. They would not be allowed to play with other people's money. And what's interesting is both in the Cambridge study, you know, when they're interviewed, they say there's plenty of regulation. We don't need more regulation. And if you talk to a lot of the developers I talked to in Aspen, they are oblivious not only to the existence of these standards and the fact that they represent best practices, but when you suggest they ought to incorporate them, they look at you like you're mad. And, you know, and yet we continue to see exchanges hacked and people lose. You know, one of the other links I put up was a presentation by Jan McAfee, whose company is a major miner, describing the security issues, particularly on the transactions. So not the security issues when you're sitting in blockchain, but the security issues when you are transacting. And John McAfee, who has been a leader in this industry for decades, is saying he loses a couple $1,000s on every transaction as a result of user error. So we're talking about not only the Wild West here, but an industry that doesn't even know what best practices is. And if you try and bring it up, thinks it's irrelevant.
So I have a number of other points to bring up. So let me drop this
okay,
one.
Keep
in.
Going.
Bitcoin's, but what you added was absolutely essential. Bitcoins don't exist anywhere. There is talk about someone having Bitcoins, but when you look at a particular Bitcoin address, there are no digital Bitcoins held in it in the same way that you might hold dollars in a bank account. You cannot point to a physical object or even a digital file and say, this is a Bitcoin. Instead, there are only records of transactions between different addresses with balances that increase and decrease, thus the need for the blockchain. Every transaction that ever took place is stored in this vast public ledger called the blockchain. If you want to work out the balance of any Bitcoin address, the information isn't held at that address. You must reconstruct it by looking at the blockchain. So somebody made a comment to me once, gee, I wonder what happens when AI invades the blockchain. We can imagine with that piece of information. Okay. Because Bitcoins exist only as records of transactions, you can end up with many different transactions tied to a particular Bitcoin address. So perhaps Jane sent Alice 2 Bitcoins. Philip sent her 3 Bitcoins, and Eve sent her a single Bitcoin, all as separate transactions at separate times. These are not automatically combined in Alice's wallet to make one file containing 6 Bitcoins. They simply sit there as different transactional records. When Alice wants to send Bitcoins to Bob, her wallet will try to use transaction records with different amounts that add up to the number of Bitcoins that she wants to send Bob. The chances are that when Alice wants to send Bitcoins to Bob, she won't have exactly the right number of Bitcoins from other transactions. Perhaps she only wants to send 1.5 to Bob. None of the transactions that she has in her Bitcoin address are for that amount, and none of them add up to that amount when combined. Alice can't just split a transaction into smaller amounts. You can only spend the whole output of a transaction rather than breaking it up into smaller amounts. Instead, she will have to send one of the incoming transactions, and then the rest of the Bitcoins will be returned to her as change. Alice sends the 2 Bitcoins that she got from Jane to Bob. Jane is the input and Bob is the output, but the amount is only 1.5 because that is all she wants to send. So her wallet automatically creates 2 outputs for transactions, 1.5 to Bob and 0.5 to a new address, which is created for Alice to hold her change for Bob. How's that for ease of transaction?
Well, we have one subscriber who complains because their exchange limited them to $1,000 a day. So imagine going to your brokerage account, selling $25,000, and having it take 25 days, $1,000 each.
There you go. And right. And you could cry. There's probably hundreds of things like that you could point to. Never mind once the regulators get going.
Right.
So here, proof of work represented by the longest chain that's containing the most computational work or hashing. That's the one that it finds valid. The one that shows the most work, has taken the most work, which is designed to increase in difficulty with time and in turn increases overhead and the need for more and more sophisticated and expensive mining resources over time. There are limits on how fast blocks can be generated to control the generation rate of Bitcoins, supposedly to control inflation. There's limits and minimums on the size of blocks. There's limits on the number of Bitcoins that can be reduced in total. You talked about that. And in turn, that creates a situation where Bitcoin will be commodified. It basically has to become a speculative investment in the end, in and of itself. And thus, that alone undermines its function as a universal currency.
Well, we'll get there. It's not a currency. In other words,
right.
You have a mining community that wants it to be a currency, but it's not a currency yet. Their hope is that it will be a currency. Right now, it's just a speculative investment. We'll get into that,
right.
In a minute. But let's just make clear, this is not a currency, which is not to say that on occasion you can't use it like a currency, but it doesn't meet the standards of a real currency yet.
That's right. And that's part of the case of what I'm making. A mechanism for subdividing Bitcoins to increase liquidity once that total limit of 21 million is reached. It's called a Satoshi, named in the honor of Satoshi, and it's 100 millionth of a single Bitcoin. I believe the smallest transaction you can send today is 5,430 Satoshis. And, of course, some exchanges wouldn't even allow that. Irreversibility of a transaction, which also means no ability to recover a Bitcoin once it's gone, that is, spent or stolen.
Right.
Bitcoin Core runs on generic databases that require a fair amount of processing that is not relevant for cryptocurrencies. The two major ones are LevelDB for indexing, which is a creation of Google, and BerkeleyDB 4.8 to manage the wallet debt and keys, which comes from Oracle. Once I found that out, I had a big chuckle. As part of the blockchain, data is processed by every node. As the number of Bitcoins increases and the number of transactions on the network increase, difficulty for mining is designed to increase as well. And theoretically, the network becomes more secure because of the cost involved with attacking it and computational resources and electricity. But the bigger it gets, the slower it gets. Data processed by every node creates a chain reaction of decreased propagation time as the slowest node creates the bottleneck. You're only as good as your weakest link in this system. Messages in Bitcoin Core are processed in a queue. This means that slower messages from a node or denial of service attacks on the protocol can cause block propagation delays. A blockchain is one-dimensional and obeys the queue, so if it reaches capacity, it has only one way to go, backwards, creating transaction backlogs. Orphan rate increases for many reasons, also bogging the system down. Orphans are detached or orphan blocks that appear valid but which are not part of the main chain. They can occur naturally when two miners produce blocks at similar times and the system has to choose one block over the other, orphaning one, or they can be caused by an attacker with superior hashing power attempting to reverse transactions. And finally, there are extreme memory requirements given how blockchain is indexed and how copies of block headers are stored. So heavy overhead. Just more making the case of why this can't be a currency, because it becomes harder and harder to use. It becomes less efficient. It becomes less scalable. It becomes more time-consuming, more resource-consuming.
So a lot of what the conference was about was agreement that blockchain and Bitcoin as they're currently constituted cannot scale and cannot be economic. And the focus is on, okay, how do we create open ledger database technology and cryptocurrencies that can scale and can be economic? So to me, if you look at what Mr. Global once prototyped here, those are the two of the biggest issues of what he once prototyped. And the other thing he once prototyped is, how do you make something quantum resistant that his quantum computers can backdoor?
That's right, which I was getting to. Blockchain are not quantum computer resistant, and thus can theoretically right. be hacked.
Can I just stop you here for 1 second? When I was trying to do the due diligence with Court on this, I came to the conclusion, okay, this thing depends on four secret decoder rings, most around the hash function, and I need to prove to myself that it's not backdoored, because I've never seen Mr. Global, I've never seen Central Intelligence let anything like this out that they couldn't backdoor. Now, one of the things McAfee makes clear is they can backdoor, you know, almost everything through the practical reality of how it's used, as well as the keystroke, you know, technology of when you get to the moment of having to transact, they can backdoor through the transaction mechanism by a variety of different mechanisms. But my question is, can they backdoor through the secret decoder rings? And what was interesting is I haven't been able to prove it one way or another. And that's talking with or working with the smartest people I know in this area. But when I got there, what I was hearing from people there is they believe it's backdoored.
But that's also why I wanted to mention that some of the core technology for the databases is coming from Google and Oracle.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
So,
but you are being subtle. I'm not subtle, Harry.
Well, I cannot be subtle, too. So there. Right. There should be full-blown quantum computers in 5 years. So the ultimate goal of cryptology is you want the ability for an entity to crack a code to have to take more time, processing time, than the years in the universe. That's kind of the ideal. Well, Bitcoin uses an encryption key called SHA-256, which I mentioned before. For a classical right. computer, this would require 2 to the 256 power computations to crack the code. That's 2 times itself, 256 times. That's a big number. But for a quantum computer, because of the way it's structured, it would only require 256 to the 3 power iterations, or 256 times itself 3 times, a much, much, much smaller number. And ironically, Bitcoin has scaled faster than Moore's Law. You know, Moore's Law basically says that prices halve every 18 months for processing power, while it doubles in the same time span. So traditional efficiencies in technology cannot help maintain the Bitcoin system's efficiency, ongoing efficiency. Okay, so, you know, and Colin Cantrell himself, you know, talked about, he basically talked about 8 or 9 things that are major problems. Transaction fees are too high, resource requirements are too high, transaction process is too slow, mining pools are centralizing, energy requirements for security are too high, micro transactions aren't possible. You know, people want to be able to buy bubblegum with this thing. Good luck. Blocks are votes, but now are only accessible by very few. Bitcoin should be trustless. That was one of the whole points of Satoshi's paper. But you have to trust somebody, as it turns out. So,
right.
So I want to make this very key point in Satoshi's paper. On a number of occasions in various ways, he confirms that the system only works as long as honest nodes, miners, control more CPU power than any cooperating group of attacker nodes. But the ultimate irony is that by having to build an increasing complexity into the mining function, and remember, mining is primarily about keeping the network vital through hashing, through intense computation, an arms race was created where increasing processing capability would be required to stay in the game, thus allowing those with the greatest financial resources who could afford the most of the latest, greatest in processing power and the associated electric bill to centralize control. He
right.
ends a section on his paper on incentive with the following paragraph. If a greedy attacker is able to assemble more CPU power than all the honest nodes, he would have to choose between using it to defraud people by stealing back his payments or using it to generate new coins. He ought to find it more profitable to play by the rules, such rules that favor him with more new coins than everyone else combined, than to undermine the system and the validity of his own wealth. So my comment to Mr. Satoshi is, perhaps you are unaware of an autonomous deep state with hidden and virtually unlimited funding and computing power whose main objective is control. If you have control of the money will come. Centralized
right.
control.
So let me just mention something. And somebody who can steal $21 trillion can control Bitcoin all day long.
For numbers of ways, but now there's internal ways to control it, which was never supposed to happen. So let me just finish my thought, then I'm going to set you loose. Centralized control leads to centralized control of wealth as well. Isn't it ironic that one of the primary goals of Bitcoin, the creation of a universal digital currency, is also a primary goal of the globalists, the New World Order with its aspiration for replacing national sovereignty with one world government, and arguably the deep state. Okay, so my punchline here is, it seems that Bitcoin has failed to deliver on all of its promises. Decentralization, democratization, incorruptibility, disintermediation, getting rid of middlemen, efficiency, fast transactions, reliability, cheap transaction costs, confidentiality. And in turn, it has failed a scalable currency and is basically a highly speculative, volatile financial play, which if enough people buy in, the value will go up and in turn will be making relatively few people very rich. Again, at the current price of $43,000 and an initial price of a few cents, this turns out to be roughly 400,000 times the rate of return for a few very early players in the few years. Unprecedented and also unimaginable in the history of finance. So that's what I wanted to say. I'm opening it up to you.
Right. It is the most sophisticated op yet. I mean, I've lived through so many of these and I've watched people, you know, get lost into the fever. Now, one of the things I wanted to mention was a point I made repeatedly throughout the conference was we have a governance structure that is invisible. And part of that governance structure is the financial system. It's a subset. And you can't change or redesign the financial system without understanding and having a design for your governance system. So thinking that changes in the financial system are going to help improve the governance system is nuts because the two are intimately integrated. The third thing I said is we've now added to this information systems. And if you look at all three, we have a governance system that has no integrity or very little integrity. We have a financial system which has not enough integrity. And now we have information systems that don't have integrity. And if you think that you can create a digital product on the information systems that have no integrity and use it to change the financial system in a way that doesn't have integrity, and you're going to improve the governance system, that's nuts. Makes no sense.
So I want to stress your second point, because you said this on a number of occasions, and it actually had a profound effect on some people, including Kucinich. You can't use a financial instrument to improve your governance system.
Right. And one of the reasons you can't is control occurs analog by force, by physical force. Now, yes, they use financial systems. Yes, they use information systems. They will do anything to keep the force invisible. You know, but it wasn't invisible this weekend in Las Vegas. And ultimately, force, you know, is what runs it. Now, I lived through the feds coming at me with force, you know, slapping down subpoenas, showing up with, you know, guns on their side at the door. And the first people to piddle on the floor and say yes, sir, and give them everything they wanted was the guys running the ISPs. It's pretty funny to watch, you know, the freedom fighters who talked a big game. Woo! Were they scared? But control is run by force. And you've got to deal with that. If you're going to change the governance system, you got to bring transparency to it, and you have to deal with the physical force issue.
Okay, and so I just want to mention this one thing, because it was very, you're pointing out that you can't use a financial instrument to change governance systems.
Right.
Because there was all these bright-eyed, idealistic people there that kept thinking that somehow Bitcoin was going to save the world. It was going to save democracy. It was going to bring transparency and force transparency on our governance system and our banking system in ways that has never been possible before. So you basically pulled out the rug from underneath them.
Well, it was funny because the first time I did it, I had that wonderful Ed Griffin sitting next to me, and then he went second and he said, you know, I thought, what am I doing here? These guys aren't going to want to hear what I have to say, and I wouldn't be free to say what I want to say. But now that Catherine just said that, let me just dive in and agree with her. You know, because there's nobody on the planet, I think, outside of the intelligence agencies, who understand the governance system better than Ed Griffin. So, you know, it was funny because all the folks who struggled for many, many decades to try and understand the governance system and get real change, you know, they were all very clear. And it's funny, I'll skip ahead for a second. On the panel with Dennis and Patrick, you know, someone in the audience said, oh, well, this is going to blow up the central bank, so when are they going to come and shut this down? And I said, why would they shut this down? If you're a central bank, you know, you are trying to buy gold and you're the smart money. You know, the smart money's trying to buy gold and you're trying to buy land. But meantime, you've printed all these dollars and you need a way to soak those dollars up. And so if you can pump Bitcoin and get everybody buying zeros and ones, that keeps the gold price down, which is the smoke alarm. It keeps the land price down, which is a smoke alarm. And you're massively accumulating that. The land holdings of the top 100 landowners since 2008 has almost doubled. So it leaves you free to accumulate the gold and the land without triggering or setting off an indication of hyperinflation. And so the reason you wouldn't shut this down is because it's fabulous. It's working for you.
Yeah, it's helping prototype a digital currency for the entire world.
Right.
And also it's prototyping the use of blockchain, which is going to be very useful for a lot of people. As a matter of fact, remember, who was it? I think it was Kucinich himself, who made a list of all these gigantic banking institutions and government organizations that were basically using the blockchain or doing a heavy research into the blockchain about how it could be useful for them to conduct their business. So that's going on at the same time.
China has shut down Bitcoin, both the exchanges and the trading, recently. And we saw between September, let's talk about Bitcoin as a speculative investment. So it's not a currency yet because it's not liquid enough and it doesn't sort of fit that criteria. But it is a speculative investment. And the thing that makes it attractive to people is they're hungry for capital gains. And it's been generating this year fantastic capital gains. And you've got, you know, people saying, Max Keiser saying it's going to go to 100,000 and John McAfee saying it's going to go to 500,000. At the same time, he's telling you you're going to lose it all through an exchange hack. It's kind of funny. But, you know, but that is absolutely making it attractive. Now, my point to everyone is if you look at how thin the market is relative to any of the commodities or financial markets, if I can steal $21 trillion, I can pump Bitcoin all day long.
Either way, up or down?
Of course. Now, the Chinese regulators. So I have people coming in and saying, well, should I buy Bitcoin? You know, even if it's a pump and it's worthless, you know, I want to play. If it's a political plump, I want to play. So on September 1st, between September 1st and September 14th, we saw the price drop 40% because the Chinese came in and said they're outlawing the exchanges. Then they outlawed them. Then they came out and said they were outlawing the trading. And I don't know if they've implemented that yet or not. So if you had put money in on the 1st, you know, 2 weeks later, you'd be down 40%. Now, the price has come back most of the way at this point. But, you know, we're looking at that kind of volatility. It's one of the reasons I say it's speculative. The other is, obviously, it's a political prototype. You know, here's the question for somebody who wants to do Bitcoin. I think this pump is far from over, Harry, because if you look at what Mr. Global needs prototyped, it's a lot more. So we have, as Dennis said, we have the Netherlands central bank, you know, working on this. We have the U.S. central bank working on this. We have the Chinese central bank working on. Everybody's working on what can they do with blockchain, and should they do a cryptocurrency? India central bank is working on it. So, you know, the we're off to the races one way or the other. We don't know what will happen. And that's why I think it's so important that, you know, people like you and I understand it, and my subscribers understand it, because this is going to be present.
I wanted to make a couple points. By the way, the Griffin you're talking about is G. Edward Griffin, and he was the guy that wrote the Creature from Jekyll Island that was the main expose on how the Federal Reserve was created. The other thing is South Korea just very recently also banned ICOs. You know, IPO is a initial public offering. This is an initial coin offering. But they left open, and I think if you look at China too, they're leaving open the possibility for still having cryptocurrencies used. They haven't outlawed cryptocurrencies themselves.
Right.
So actually what this does, it actually is a way of limiting competition for new cryptocurrencies to come in, and to have people like Bitcoin and those other, you know, the few Elysium and a few standing players get even stronger in this domain, which I think is quite interesting. The other irony that I found was, you know, in one of these panel discussions that we were sitting in, this kid was talking about how, you know, he travels the country doing using Bitcoins and all this, and I pay for my gasoline and everything else. I was sitting behind him, so I passed him a little note. I asked him, I said, when you bought your gasoline, did you convert your Bitcoins into dollars? And of course, he never answered. But it's just amazing also about how, you know, they constantly value Bitcoin in terms of another currency. You know, they're always going back to, oh, it's worth this many yen or this many euros or this many dollars. So wait a minute, it's supposed to replace this thing, but yet you don't really have an understanding of what it's worth until you convert it to something you understand. That's pretty interesting, I thought.
So let me keep going. So number one, the price may go up because Mr. Global wants to pump. Number two, I think the price may go up because if they allow ICOs, you're going to see a lot more activity. So an ICO is essentially issuing a coin that can act. It's almost like issuing equity shares. It's a way around all the restrictions on issuing equity shares. So in essence, you can participate in the entity. And we saw the SEC shut it down. It was how new cryptocurrencies were coming out. The SEC shut down ICOs by saying they may choose to regulate them, and that put the kibosh on it. The third thing that could cause the price to go up is if the SEC approves ETFs, it's going to solve major custodian issues. So one of the big issues, Harry, is to whether people would buy gold or not. You know, they didn't want to have to put it in a depository. They didn't want to have to put it in a safe at home. The custodian issues were too much work for them or created too much risk. And then when GLD came out, which was the big gold ETF, it sucked huge amounts of money out of the physical gold market because everybody said, oh, I can go to my brokerage account and just buy it with a click. So if I can go to my brokerage account and buy Bitcoin with a click and I can speculate, then I'm fast in, fast out. And that's going to bring, I mean, if the SEC allows ETFs, that is the indication that Mr. Bitcoin is ready to take, I mean, Mr. Global is going to take this to a whole new level.
So, okay, and also comment about the impact potentially this whole thing could have on small banks and community banks.
Okay, let me just keep going. If you look at the regulatory treatments of this, we're 2% of the way into a full regulatory treatment, whether by the tax authorities, the SEC, you know, and a variety of banking regulators, which means, you know, in the early stage of prototype, they'll generally leave you alone. But once they decide to centralize this, you know, you could see the price brought down to zero.
Absolutely.
Right.
The point is they can turn on the regulation switch from 4,000 different directions at any time that they want to.
Right. So I would say this is a pump and dump where the price can go to 100,000 and the price can go to zero. And there's no way tell which it is. So there are many different laws about how you handle and manage a speculative investment like that. So if you want to play, just be prepared to handle it accordingly that way. Now, here's what you need to know. I don't own Bitcoin. Somebody sent me some Bitcoin, which I have in an exchange. It's sitting there. I think it's $19 worth. I'm not going to buy any Bitcoin. And one of the reasons I'm not going to buy any Bitcoin is I never spend any time financing my own demise.
There you go. That's the primary reason not to, right there.
Right. My time is too precious. But the other thing is, if you look, one of the things that has happened not inadvertently, because it wasn't inadvertent from Mr. Global's standpoint, if you buy Bitcoin, you are going to be put on a list. And right now, what Bitcoin has managed to do is put a huge amount of money into the hacking community. We have capitalized cyber terrorism to an extreme extent. You've put billions of dollars into the hacking community's pockets. Is that fair to say?
Well, and that's right. And there's another side of the coin which you brought up, which I think is very important. If you know how to work the system, you can use the anonymous feature of the system to fund all kinds of things and not have accountability. You want to talk about that too.
So I don't want to be on their list, and I don't want to be involved. I don't want to receive money anonymously.
I don't want to make some of the fat slobs that I saw at this conference that were obnoxious with gigantic amounts of hubris that were talking so much crap rich. That's another reason.
Well, I always feel sorry for people who are lost in a fever because I've seen a lot of lives destroyed. And even when they're in the hubris phase, I get scared for what's going to happen to them when it goes the other way. But I don't want to be on the list, and I don't want to be connected to that community.
I think one of the major things going on here is the prototyping of a universal digital currency, in particular a cryptocurrency, that will then be put into effect by governments, because they ultimately will want the monopoly on this. They're not going to give it up.
Right, and here's the thing. The monopoly is delivered by force. So let's talk about what happens to the banks. When Goldman Sachs came out the other couple weeks ago and said that they were going into retail lending off a website, I thought, what is that about? And yet, as I dug deeper into Bitcoin and blockchain, what I realized is, the only banks that are going to be left standing are the ones that have the government monopoly delivered by force. And of course, access to $21 trillion and all the other benefits of the federal credit. So if you take the ones that got bailed, if you look at the New York Fed member banks who got bailed out during the bailouts and the San Francisco member, you know, banks that got bailed out. So you take big San Francisco, big New York, East Coast, West Coast. Those guys on the bailouts came out smelling like a rose. They significantly increased their market share. They significantly increased their power. You know, the bailouts were great for them. They won. Now, they're also the ones implementing the illegal transactions. The $21 trillion had to go out through their train tracks, although some could be assets stolen. But to the extent it's cash or securities, they would be the one to implement all those illegal transactions. And if you look at the size and extent, it's not like they don't know. they continue to sell government securities despite the fact they know the government is in violation of Constitution and financial management law. So those banks are now going to double down on their win on the bailouts and their win on the missing money. Now they're going to be able to use this technology to basically put out of business 8,000 community banks and 5,000 community credit unions, which is going to shut down all liquidity locally in America. It is the last blow to deliver to destroy local economies.
That's right, because if you have basically a centralized transaction medium that allows you to transfer stuff incredibly cheaply all around the world, and it's controlled by basically a few key players, a few bankers in the central bank, you know, well, then it becomes much, much more cost ineffective to do business, you know, locally. And but I want to talk about a couple other things that you have said in the past, which are very relevant here. You talk about analog force being a major factor, and that's how they basically get their will and enforce and control power and centralized power. But you also have talked about how that's expensive, and that's the other reason why so much investment has gone into other methods of control, mind control, entrainment, and all these other things, which in fact you're addressing, you know, head on in your next Solari quarterly, right?
Right, and what I saw, because what we saw at the conference is a lot of wonderful young people who are literally lost in virtual reality and are consuming massive amounts of entrainment, subliminal programming, and other mind control techniques. I mean, that's what gets people addicted to pornography, addicted to online gambling, addicted to all these different things. And, you know, in the smartphone, the cell tower network that they got up by August 2001 and the smartphone, you know, propagation is what has really delivered this stuff. And, you know, it gets people, when you add that to a rising price, it gets people in a state of fever. And it's like they lose their mind and they don't know it.
So two important points here that we both came to the conclusion. You know, when you got a front door like a smartphone, you don't need a back door nearly as much. And the other thing that you said was that, you know, a portion of that $21 trillion has been spent to lay down these train tracks of mind control, that whole network, basically an analog network that, you know, that includes cell towers and other things that have the ability to enact these technologies, these mind control technologies. So basically, those train tracks are in place also to make this thing happen. But the other thing I want to add, like with any revolutionary movement, these guys will let this run long enough so that there'll be enough, you know, currencies involved. There'll be enough chaos. There'll be enough problems that then basically people will be asking the government to step in for further regulation, for further centralization. They love to do that.
Right. Oh, if you read the Master Switch, what you see is when it centralizes, of course, you know, the government is bringing best practices and, you know, the same standards of securities regulation that we have in securities we need to bring here. You know, it's all, and don't worry, you can go to your brokerage account and click and buy some of this stuff. So, yeah, so when they're ready to centralize, you know, they'll be there. It was really funny because everybody kept saying this was a grassroots revolution. And I kept telling the story, which I've told on the Solari Report several times, of going, being in Basel to interview the wonderful Thomas Meyer, then driving to the train station in Basel, Switzerland, by the, you know, driving right by the Bank of International Settlements, the Central Bank of Central Bank, going to the Swiss Federal Railway Station and being presented with the option to buy my ticket in Bitcoin. And not only that, to buy Bitcoin from the Swiss Federal Railway Station to top up my wallet. On the idea, of course, that the BIS couldn't stop that if it didn't want that to be happening. It was so funny.
If I was a detective or a forensic accountant, that one piece of evidence might solve the problem for me. This is an op.
Right. So let's turn to politics, because one of the things that did come up at the conference was the political implications of this and what it meant. And you and I were part of a presentation, or in the audience for a presentation, we both asked questions. sort of and participated in the discussion. And if I hadn't been there, I wouldn't believe it. And I've described it to various subscribers who just can't believe it was really that bad. But now what's interesting, so let me give the history and just point out that you can go to the person's website and read their platform, and it really is their bed because it's right up there on the web.
I will also bear witness.
right. So I think it was the presentation was Saturday morning. So the conference was 3 days, so Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and you and I were regularly, one of the first panels I did was in the, it was in the Koch brothers building. So here we are in a building named after the Koch brothers, and the room we're in is Booz Allen Hamilton, which is one of the biggest government contractors, but I think one of the biggest of the CIA. And we're listening to people talk about how we're all part of a grassroots revolution, and I'm thinking, how can that be if we're sitting in the Booz Allen Hamilton room in the Koch building at the Aspen Institute? And every time you walk to the, you know, walk to the facilities, you're looking at $25 to $50 million houses lined up, you know, above you along the mountain. I'm thinking, how is this a grassroots revolution? But anyway, so I think it was Saturday morning. We went to see a presentation by an Iraqi vet who's running for. He calls it not for president, but he's running for president, and he's receiving all of his donations anonymously on Bitcoin. And I've checked, and I don't understand how that's legal, but let's put that aside for a second. And so here's a guy who's being financed privately, anonymously, and he can say that he doesn't know where his money's coming from. He's got apparently a new RV or a big RV, which is pretty expensive, driving around the country. And his platform is as follows. One is you win the presidency, and on the first day you shut down the government. The second thing you do is you take the remaining assets and operations and you put them in a trust fund, and then you privatize them. Now, basically, so I stood up and said, well, it's interesting that you propose this because this is the plan that the U.S. intelligence agencies used to implode Russia. It's called the Rape of Russia. It was documented by Ann Williamson. We have several Solari reports on that. And if you do a search for Ann Williamson and Rape of Russia, you can read her congressional testimony about what happened. Anyway, but I continued and I pointed out that during that period, 10 to 20, the population dropped by 10 to 25 million people, because when you implode 50% or more of the household incomes, people die off pretty quickly. You know, if it takes 2 to 5 years to build an orchard and a garden and livestock to eat, you know, you know, in a plan like this, because you're going to stop overnight 50% approximately of the household incomes in any community in America, at which point they're going to have, if they have 1 to 3 weeks of food, 1 to 3 weeks of cash, and they can live for 1 to 3 weeks without food, maybe they go 3 to 9 weeks and then they start to die off rapidly. So, at which point he pointed out that we, you know, we needed to be less materialistic. And if I hadn't been there, I wouldn't have believed it. I wouldn't have believed it because either the U.S. intelligence, I checked the guy out. He was busted in Northern Virginia. This is Adam Kokesh. He's got a website with his platform on it. He was busted in Virginia in 2013 for drugs and guns, but managed to somehow cop a plea where he admitted guilt without being indicted or convicted of a felony, or without being convicted of a felony, I should say. And how he got that deal, I don't know, but it makes you wonder who's got his leash now. Anyway, so I listened to it, and if you hadn't been there to affirm that it was that nuts, to me what it says is they're either organizing the kids to believe this kind of ya-ya, or they're really planning on trying it. And of course, everybody was all excited because, oh yes, with blockchain we can implode the U.S. government, and they didn't seem to understand that they were talking about wiping out their family, their parents and their grandparents' family wealth and all the wealth they would inherit. They didn't seem to notice that or understand it. So maybe if you could talk a little bit about what it looked like to you, what it sounded to you, what happened, because I just need a witness to to document this really did happen.
Yeah, well, you've never said anything in the history of me knowing you that wasn't immaculately accurate. And I would say that you were maybe even a little bit kind because, you know, when I said to the guy, wait a minute, by doing this, you're basically wiping out the liability, that $21 trillion that's been lost or any hope of recovering it. He said, well, you know, I can't make promises that you would get that back. And you just have to, you know, realize that you may not. You just got to get, you know, used to living with less money. I mean, that's basically what the hell he said. And,
well,
you know, I didn't go back at him. But, are you serious? But the point is, because you and I brought up a couple of these things, there were people that came up afterwards and said, you know, there was something fishy about this guy. One guy even said, yeah, my roommate said that this guy is probably a CIA front. Now I believe it. And you know, and then even young people were coming up to you saying, boy, I'm glad you said that because, you know, kind of woke me up from this daze I was in believing this guy. So what I would say is that there's the prototyping about the best way to convince people that we need to shred the Constitution being done in many different ways with many different flavors, lots of different recipes all around us now.
Yeah, so we have the Baskin-Robbins version of how to tear up the Constitution. So you're watching, and I think Bitcoin is instrumental to this, financing all these different, you know, marketings of let's tear up the Constitution. So one of the things this guy said, oh, the Constitution is old. You know, it's passé. It's out of date. It's out of date. So this is Goldman Sachs' wet dream, and I'm sorry to pick on Goldman Sachs. I used to work there, so I feel free to pick on them. But, you know, basically you've stolen 24 to 27 trillion in the bailouts. Now you've stolen 21 trillion missing money. You know, you made the money on the pump and dump of the tax, and you made the money on the housing bubble. So you're rolling in dough. Now, how do you tear up the obligations? Because now that you've stolen what you can steal so far, you need to tear up all the obligations. You need to tear up the military pension funds. You need to tear up the
Social Security
trust fund. You need to tear up. You have all sorts of obligations. Your obligations on mortgage insurance, flood insurance, all the different insurance programs. How do you tear that up? Well, you get the young people to say it's a revolution and we want to tear it up, and then you say, well, it's not our fault. That's what the young people want. You wanted to tear it up. It's not our idea. And then what do you want to do? You can't launder the federal lands. You can't launder the national forest out with the missing money. I mean, you can build a lot of planes and jets and arms, and you can steal those, but you can't steal, you know, Yellowstone. So this idea of, oh, well, then we have to auction that off so we can pay the debt, you know, sure, then, but once, if you auction it after you implode the economy, the price will be 1% of what it would be today if you auctioned it off. So if I auction, what's the most beautiful federal land in Montana?
Glacier National Park.
Okay. So if I auctioned off Glacier National Park today, I would get one price. If I auctioned it off after I had abruptly canceled 50% of household income in America, what am I going to pay if I auctioned it then?
Well, remember, too, that Goldman Sachs made money a third way by basically having a $19 trillion debt. And through this process, not only did we lose the recovery of assets that were stolen, we also get burdened with this $19 trillion, continue to be burdened by it. I mean, he didn't give any plan about how we're going to get rid of that, except that, yeah, we're going to cinch our waistlines and we're going to use resources to basically, you know, pay off our debts.
Right. So they own your property because your property is collateral for the debt.
Well, Glacier Park certainly is.
Yeah. So here's what I'm saying, because somebody will tell me, well, we can't get the $21 trillion missing back. Well, first of all, I disagree. I think there are ways of getting it back. But second of all, it's a very different discussion if it's on the table. So if Goldman Sachs says, well, we want to auction off, you know, this land because we need to do it, you know, it's a different discussion that says, wait a minute, you just stole $21 trillion. We're not auctioning anything until you put that $21 trillion back in the till. So even, you know, making it transparent and clear and holding people publicly accountable in the court of popular opinion, to me, radically changes the policy discussion.
I think, I've mentioned this to you, that I feel the door is closing, and I feel many different ops coming to the froth here, frothing up and coming to the forefront in many different directions, including, you know, trying to take your guns away with this massacre, and, you know, Social Security numbers now being declared even by the executive branch as obsolete after the breach at Equifax. And, you know, instead of going, hey, you guys are a bunch of slobs, and maybe we shouldn't have these gigantic data pools. Oh, the Social Security number and its vulnerability is to blame. So we need to chip everybody. It's just coming everywhere all at once. And from my perspective, it's almost designed to overwhelm the system's ability to cope, and even the citizenry ability to comprehend and cope.
So if you look at Charlottesville, if you look at Bitcoin, if you look at Las Vegas, you're trying to create so much incoherence that people aren't coherent enough to say, wait a minute, you're not taking my gun away. And I understand what my legal rights are, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm going to act on this.
You're not going to force vaccinate my kids and on and on.
Right. Right, but we're coming to a point, and if you look at Charlottesville, if you look at accelerating false flags, what I would say is, you know, they've tried like crazy to get gun control for quite a while, and they've failed consistently, and somebody's getting very frustrated and pushing very hard. So this is, you know, the S-curve is accelerating, and we're coming to what I call nut-cutting time faster than I expected.
Right.
Because, you know, one of the interesting things about Las Vegas is it was pretty sloppy. You know, if you look at some of the earlier ones, this one was relatively sloppy. Charlottesville was sloppy. I was stunned. CNN had six citizens on, and they were trying to push, you know, whatever the line was. And they had this very charming black woman in the front row who clearly looked like somebody who would vote Democrat. And the woman said, well, you know, the conservatives were the one who did the killing. And the woman said, no, that happened because the police stood down. And it, you know, wasn't working. So anyway, so all I'm saying is it's coming to a head. And that's why I've always said you don't need everybody. You need 5 to 10%. And the thing that concerns me the most here, Harry, is not the false flags or the different kinds of spin. The thing that concerns me the most is the entrainment technology. Because if you look at people being tricked, they don't understand that with artificial intelligence and database software, they can take that 5 to 10% who might stand up, and they can work them through the phones and computers one by one. In other words, the niche marketing on tearing up the Constitution is one by one. And they're using very intimate and invasive technology to do it. And they have that capacity.
You've always talked about the railroad tracks going to those thousands of communities on an individual level. And I told you my story, you know, yeah, I always understood that that was possible. But it didn't hit home until in this very small Montana town, you know, that had almost nothing going and half of the buildings vacated. There was this, you know, Masonic lodge.
Right.
You know, so, but now you've got it hypercharged through technology. Now you can basically get down to the individual level. At any time, using technologies that aren't even understood, admitted exist.
Right. Right.
But you have a very important message to deliver on this, because you can't succumb to hopelessness. This is a very important message. So it's a very important message to deliver at this time, with things closing down, with all these ops going on, with the heat being turned up. We need to stay focused. on our principles and what we stand for. And you know, you have other important messages here, so you should deliver those now, I think.
Right. Okay, so one of the things I did want to point out was that I think one of the most powerful attractions of blockchain technology and cryptocurrency is I think there is, first and foremost, within the population, there is very powerful desire to create money and create currencies. And the greatest desire is local currencies. And one of the interesting thing about this prototype is Mr. Global is encouraging and allowing the prototyping of virtual currencies, but Mr. Global is not allowing the prototyping of local currencies. And that's very important because what we all need is a currency, whether it's virtual or not, that can operate analog in our place. And, right, it's a very, very key point. So that's number one. The second thing is that in a time where you're going through this much change, the single most important thing you need to use your time for, or the single most important asset you have is your time. And one of the things that's happened over the last week is every time I turn around, I'm getting questions about another one of Mr. Global's distractions or pumps and dumps. So I'm being asked about Charlottesville. I'm being asked about Las Vegas. I'm being asked about
Bitcoin.
Right. I'm being asked about Bitcoin. And it's almost as though when it comes to the investment of your time, Mr. Global is commanding your attention. You know, of course, the big one, as you said, is hopelessness, which is another op. My favorite quote from John Rappaport is, hopelessness is an op and it's planet-wide. So, you know, I should add hopelessness to the list. So people are investing their time in response to the distractions and the pumps and dumps and the games that Mr. Global is playing. Instead of sitting down and saying, okay, in this environment, we're going up what I call the S-curve between Global 2.0 and 3.0. My most precious asset is my time and resources. How do I invest my time and resources in a way where not only am I and my family safe and coherent and, you know, sane, but how do I do it in a way that helps shift the system? Because if we don't all contribute to shifting this in a more positive direction, you know, every person who stopped gun control over the last 10 years, if they hadn't done that, do you know where you and I would be today, Harry?
I live in Montana. I think it's part of the state constitution that they can never confiscate your guns.
Okay. So the third thing that's driving, so local, you know, local currencies, distraction. The third thing that's driving Bitcoin value or blockchain value is people. Right now, I can transact domestically very efficiently through banks and very low cost, certainly much lower cost and much faster and easier than Bitcoin. However, internationally, it's very uncomfortable and it's very expensive. And there is no doubt that the market dramatically, dramatically, dramatically wants much faster cross-border payments at much lower cost. Because, you know, we have 7 billion people, and if you look at the fees that are being charged on credit cards or PayPal or any of the other money services, it's way more than the emerging markets and the frontier markets can afford. And I think there's no doubt one of the things we saw at the conference that was the most interesting was applications of blockchain that would help do that or would help optimize the allocation of assets so that you could leave the financial guys out. That's my dream, is let's just cut the whole financial system and the financial guys, you know, their share of economic value is steadily increased, and we've turned everything into a financial product. Blockchain has the opportunity not only to be much more efficient, you know, cross-border, but to allow businesses to reorganize and optimize through asset management of databases and just cut the finance guys out altogether. So, you know, the reality is there's certain market hunger here that are real, and we need to acknowledge that before I just say, well, the whole thing's an op.
My concern for blockchain is that it will be viewed at a very efficient way to store all kinds of information, and that it will be worked by the central intelligence to basically make it so that more private things are made public of the citizenry, and more of the stuff that should be public, of governmental stuff, will be made even harder to find.
Okay, so let me bring to the final point, which is universal basic income. One of the things that happened in different conversations at Aspen was basically the senior people in the tech industry confirmed the same thing I've seen before. So these are people who've been remarkably successful in tech or software and who are generally not aware that most of their success comes from the subsidy of government-provided low-cost capital and government-provided technology. And the reason they're being subsidized is because they're helping to centralize things.
Yes, you know, government-subsidized, high-cost of taxpayer money.
Right. So if you look at them ecosystem-wide, they're not productive. They're not, you know, but they don't know. And they have tremendous confidence in their ability to continue to centralize. They've got the wind in their sails. And their vision is, we can do everything with artificial intelligence and software. And if you take 100% of the jobs currently in the economy, you know, we can do all of those with AI and software. And we don't need humans. We can do everything without them. And they should just go away and paint and read and play. And now, one of the things they don't realize is the reason that works is because the technology, the force, and the capital is being sent to them on a subsidized basis, and their success is not one of performance in the marketplace. It's basically the richly subsidized versus, you know, the people being drained to provide that subsidy. And it's being engineered through the government. And if I hadn't spent the last 30 years trying to unpack it, you know, it was complicated to figure out. So it's not intuitively obvious, you know, unless you've really unpacked and studied it. So they don't know. They're ignorant, you know, and they won't know until the day comes that they're either dead or they have to look in the mirror and say, I'm the patsy, because once they've finished centralizing, you don't need them. So, but right now they're the masters of the universe, and they got the bit in their teeth. Now, what they're promoting, so you see the White House yesterday, according to Bloomberg, saying, okay, well, because of the Equifax hack, we know that Social Security numbers don't work, so we need to put them on blockchain. Now, put aside the fact that that doesn't work, period, but so you put that on blockchain, you got your cryptocurrencies on blockchain, and now you have Mark Zuckerberg and a whole world of people saying, let's promote a universal basic income. Well, one sort of activist wrote to me, just published a new article on universal basic income, and wrote to me and sent it to me, and I wrote back and I said, you know, their point was, we don't need to run this through the budget. We can just print the money. And I said, well, if that's the case, why don't we just cancel taxes? We don't need to send the money all the way to Washington and do a very paperful process back. Tell you what, let's just stop them from harvesting us through taxes and covert means, and then we don't need a universal basic income. But of course, that's not the goal. We know the goal is control. But, you know, what this says between the push for universal basic income, the vision of we, the techies, can take control of everything and run it with software and AI, and the White House saying, okay, let's put the blockchain idea, you basically are putting in, as you said, the different pieces to create the mark of the beast.
That's right. And then you add the transhumanists into this thing, and you understand they want to re-engineer all life on Earth, and they want to re-engineer human beings anyway. So the whole thing seems to be reinforcing.
Right. Now, here's the question. So if I was listening to this, I'd say, okay, well, where is this going? Where this is going down to, since control is implemented by force, not by digital means, you know, what this is coming down to is gun control. So,
But the Second Amendment was never designed to overthrow the government. You know, it was designed to have militias that basically could be used to suppress insurrections in the state and troublesome people. That was the latest one from that I saw from Richard Perry.
The thing that most concerns me, when I was at Aspen, you're right. If you and I were in the audience and we brought up these issues, then it would bust the spin because the spin wasn't true. But what surprised me was how completely gullible many of the people in the audience were. So how do we get this information communicated out? What do you do?
We just did it. I mean, you know, this is pretty this is fun-filled Solari report, and it's pretty dense. And so now what do people do? Well, I mean, they keep going back to the fundamentals. That's what they do. The fundamentals right. that you have basically preached about. You know, you got to live a principled life. You've got to associate with people you can trust. You got to have a good source of food. Shut off your damn TV. Bank local, and now if you're clever and use your imagination, maybe you can use some of this stuff to make communities stronger rather than centralizing authorities strong.
Right, right. But whatever you do, if you decide to play with this, understand it's a speculative investment, and you can get burnt, and you can get on the wrong list. So. Before we close, one of the things that you and I did was, I did it with Court and then I did it with you, is I made a very detailed list of the differences between dealing with cryptocurrency versus a bank deposit. And I just want to touch on that because for people who decide they're willing to dabble in the demonic here, I just want to make sure they understand the specifics. So let me just quickly run through it.
And you're going to have that spreadsheet on online also, right?
Yes. Yes. I'm going to put it online. So if you look at database integrity, the blockchain is supposed to have integrity, but we're not sure. One thing I'm for sure, your bank deposits, I think they have integrity in the sense that if your money gets stolen, the bank and the FDIC is there to help. The bank capitalization is there to help in many instances, but clearly in terms of intelligence agencies, there's no privacy. From a regulatory standpoint, the bank deposit is highly developed and crypto is not developed. It was interesting. You and I sat in a panel on the tax treatment. You know, was the IRS said it was property, but the central bank said it was money, and there's conflicts and the regulatory treatment is not developed. And you literally had people in the audience saying, oh, well, my profits on Bitcoin are not taxable. Well, good luck with that.
Yeah, but even more so, what this meant was anytime you have appreciation in Bitcoin and then you convert it to dollars to make a purchase, you have a taxable event. That's where we stand right now. So stick that right. in your pipe and smoke it.
Right. But I'm amazed at how many people I run into who think it's not taxable. Of course, the money laundering rules are not developed. And I will tell you, I was in the process of talking to one person who was working on a project with someone who was receiving anonymous donations in Bitcoin. And I said, are you out of your mind? You can't be involved in that at all, because what's going to stop the feds from saying, you know, money laundered in from a terrorist group and you knew it, and you,
that's
you know,
right.
I can't tell you how many people who could be framed with this. If you look at what happened, what they tried to do to Hamilton Securities, what they succeeded to doing to Ross Ulbricht. I mean, you know, the speed at which you can get framed for the most ridiculous things in a system like this is you do not want to take in anonymous donations through this.
I would also add this. There is no evidentiary integrity anymore, you know, given Photoshop and all these other technologies. They can make you say anything, be anywhere, you know, right. that they wanted to. So this just makes it that much easier in a way to frame your ass.
Right. And that's why I want money coming in a way that I can confirm redundantly, and humans are always hovering. So it's one of the reasons I'm alive. You know, we would never let them get 100% control of the digital records at Hamilton. And I had, you know, it's funny, I used to have my CFO, who was fabulous, used to complain about this. He'd say, we'd get to the end of the year and he'd say, why can't we cut this budget? I had a budget of $250,000 a year, which I called white guys in ties. And it was all sort of very prominent accounting or law firms who would review and affirm all these different steps of how we're running the company or how we're running our big transactions. And so on any one of those issues, you couldn't frame me without framing one of the white guys in ties. And it turned out to be an excellent investment. So we've talked about the time expense it takes to understand and learn how to transact. If you're a busy person and you're going to learn how to, you know, participate in cryptocurrencies, right now the way it's set up, if you do this securely, it's a very high learning process. Now, I've put, you know, recommended links up. I'll put them again in this Solari report, but I strongly recommend you do proper due diligence before you mess. I can't confirm that there's no backdoor. I'm sure on the banks there is a backdoor, but again, you've got the FDIC insurance protecting you now and bank capitalization as well. So I want to get to bank deposit insurance because I think one of the reasons Mr. Global most wants to promote cryptocurrencies is Mr. Global is looking for a way to get out of deposit insurance. Again and again, deposit insurance has allowed, you know, has stopped a lot of the really horrible fraud from turning into something like the rape of Russia. And so if you can persuade people that, you know, they don't want or need deposit insurance, that's a, you know, then you're getting into solving your too big to fail. You can just stick it to everybody. That's a very big change, Harry.
Catherine, there's nobody else, like I keep saying, that has the ability and the will and to bring these very, very important points to the surface.
Okay, so next issue is domestic banks are very efficient, low cost. International, they're not. And I think that's part of the desire for Bitcoin because you have young people who are very eager to make low transaction cost international transfers. The wallet expense, if you're going to do this securely, is very expensive. So I can open a bank account without spending, you know, $100 to $300 on a wallet. Liquidity, bank deposits are phenomenally liquid in size anywhere in the world. Yes, your currency is being debased, but, you know, if you look at the security issues, I would say the liquidity on Bitcoin is very low, unless you're traveling on the Swiss Federal Railway System. Okay, let's just run through risks. The risk of an exchange failure is very high on cryptocurrencies, low on bank deposits. The loss from user error, very high on cryptocurrencies, low on bank deposits. The chances of forged checks, identity theft, fraudulent ACH are relatively small in the bank, but they exist. None on cryptocurrencies, but the chances of hack are very high on cryptocurrencies, low on banks. And again, you have the bank capitalization and FDIC protecting you. And P.S., no one is quantum resistant, which is why one of my questions, Harry, when quantum computers come out in significant size, you're going to see a big gap up in inequality is what it looks like to me. Finally, on network collapse, EMP attack, good luck getting your Bitcoin liquefied. But then on the bank deposit, you're dealing with the long-term fall of dollars and debasement, which is part of the, I think, the hunger, people thinking that Bitcoin can't be debased, and so it's a way to get out of something that's debased. The chances of new regulation hitting the value of your bank deposit is very low, extremely high for any particular one cryptocurrency. One of my concerns is if you ride one particular cryptocurrency in the pump, you know, the pump may keep going, but your particular cryptocurrency could just get taken down to zero. Given the volatility, one of the reasons it's not a currency is the store of value is very poor. Yes, dollar is getting debased, but it's not dropping 40% in 2 weeks. So you're dealing with very wide swings if you have to pay your expenses in a currency, you know, in a different currency, and you have to go back and forth. I think the piracy issue is very huge on cryptocurrencies. You're protected by FDIC or the credit union insurance, and on Bitcoin, or cryptocurrencies, you're in the Wild West. If you lose your money through user error or hacking of the exchange, good luck with finding a human being you could talk to. And finally, contribution to freedom. If you look right now at what is preserving what we have left of the local economies, it's the local banks and credit unions that are making that go. This is just going to put more power into the guys who did the bailout and the missing money. I noticed Goldman Sachs came out this week and said they're probably going to start trading Bitcoin. You know, if anything, what we need are local currencies, and we need them analog. So, you know, the one thing I will say is you can put a gold coin in your pocket and walk away, and it's analog. It can be analog or digital, and that's what we need. So my bottom line is this is Mr. Global's wet dream. And just as I said, the reason I wanted to walk through, sort of versus a bank deposit, if you need cash, if you need currency, if you need to transact with a currency, for God's sakes, use dollars, use Swiss francs, use something that is highly liquid and has mature regulatory treatment. Do not use this. And do not think that you're going to be anonymous or secretive, that you're not going to have to pay taxes. If you do this, it's a speculative investment, and you're doing it to learn about what's going on and to understand the technology, and because you think Mr. Global's going to take the pump much higher, and you understand what your risks are, and you just understand why you're doing this.
I would summarize by using your protocol, the 1.0, 2.0, 3.0. We came from a world of 1.0 where you basically had physical things that you use to exchange or as an exchange medium, whether it was gold, cash, paper, coins, sticks, whatever it was. Then you've gone to a 2.0 that involved fiat currencies, and the ultimate conclusion of fiat currencies is actually where we are now. We basically have a digital currency in the dollar, because so little of it is in cash, and basically everything is an entry, in a digital entry, in an electronic entry. That's how things are done. And now we're going to 3.0, which is involving crypto, and I can't help but think basically making what little left is private more public, and what should be public more private.
Right.
That's
a very good point. I want to underscore that, because what you're doing is you're taking that which should be public, which is the government money, including the government money by place, and you're making it more secret.
Yeah, and you can use this stuff to make secret what you want to, and to force open what you, just as part of the transaction, what you want to. So.
Well, let me come back to the Constitution, because the reason I keep coming back to the Constitution is there are certain issues. One is whether or not we have the right to own property, and two, whether or not we have the right to have free speech, whether any war has to be approved by Congress or not, whether or not we are supposed to have honest voting systems, you know, and on and on and on. And one is, we have a right to get that $21 trillion back and hold the parties responsible who affected those illegal transactions, including the banks and the contractors. So if the Constitution is maintained and enforced as we go to 3.0, to me that is an exceptionally different world than if it's not.
Right. And I think now you've made this point repeatedly, and it's so important that we need to add, you know, to living a principled life, and, you know, to eating good food, supporting your local farmer, supporting your local bank, shutting off your TV. We need to add, let's enforce the Constitution. I think this needs to become, you know, one of the four principal points of the Soleri Doctrine.
Right. So how do you communicate the fact that 3.0 with the Constitution is a very different picture than not. Because if you look at the parties who want to control in 3.0, they are being richly subsidized by illegal monies through the federal government, and they don't even know it. And if you look at the economics of that, the Constitution is the only vehicle that can turn that around legally. And so,
yeah, so I don't know how you do it more emphatically than you've done, by basically bringing it down to money, the what economic impact that has for the network and for individuals. I mean, that you've done it. You've done it dramatically. You keep doing it dramatically. You've done it repeatedly, and you need to keep doing it repeatedly, because in the end, it's going to wipe out it's going to wipe out wealth as we know it. It's going to wipe out money as we know it. It's going to wipe out freedom as we know it.
Right. I wouldn't miss money, but I would certainly miss freedom. So I guess what I'm saying is we have a mechanism that allows a small group of people to steal as much money as they want, and they're using that money to finance a complete takeover of us. You know, we've just talked about the financial aspects, but if we wanted to talk about the other analog aspects, like spraying heavy metals over our head or feeding us GMO food or destroying the soil or, you know, poisoning our children with vaccines, you know, they are using this vehicle of theft to basically engineer a total central control. And we either stop it now or if you look at where they want to go, you know, I'm always debating sometimes with you and other people. They'll say to me, oh, it's hopeless. And I say, no, it's not hopeless. Because if you look at, you know, there are two doors we can walk through. One is where we enforce now and for the next 2 years, and one is where we don't. And if you look at where the door that says we don't, it's hopeless, leads, you know, there, you know, that's not a plan. You can't survive. So people will ask me, should I buy gold or should I buy Bitcoin or should I buy securities or stocks or bonds? What should I buy? And I say, if we walk through that door, it doesn't matter, because you will be stripped of everything. You will have no individual sovereignty. And so it doesn't matter what you have, because it will be ultimately worthless. Now, I'm not saying you can't run away to Costa Rica and delay it for a little while, but you know, there's that door has no hope behind it. So my attitude is I can figure out how to enforce the Constitution, because it's the only hope I have. It's the only pathway. So if that's the only pathway by which I survive, then I can figure it out, because there is a way.
Well, you've used the parasitic analogy for quite a number of years, and that's what we've got. We've got a parasitic situation on steroids. And while we're waiting around for the Minionite thing to happen, you know, where they all kill each other, unfortunately may take us with them, you know, I think we need to come up with some pretty good anti-parasitic medicine here.
Well, as you know, one of the reasons I'm so confident that we can enforce the Constitution and we can come out of this in a better way is I believe, ultimately, one, if you look at how perverted their culture is and how out of alignment with the natural world and science it is, ultimately, I do think they'll kill each other, because it's such a negative perverted culture. But so that's why I think it's in contingent on the rest of us, you know, say that 5 to 10%, to come up with a picture and a vision for how we can make this transition with new technology so things come out to a human world instead of an inhuman world. And I do believe one of our greatest tactics is I do think the Midianites will kill each other. But we can't depend just on that. We have to create an alternative vision so people can say, it's just like at the conference. You know, the Midianite story sounded great until people heard the alternative story, and then suddenly they were scratching their head saying, wait, that's right. I don't want to go there. So, you know, the truth resonated even in the middle of the fever. And I was very pleased to see that. And I just to wind things up, Harry, if you hadn't been there, it would have been a very unpleasant and painful experience. And the fact that I had somebody with a major Ferrari brain sitting there laughing and figuring it out with me, it really turned it into one of the great events of the year.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be with you. It's an honor to be associated with you. It's also an honor for you to have asked me to do this because, you know, this is obviously not my expertise, but you've helped me create a map makes me, maybe sees things in some ways that other people don't as quickly. So I'm very grateful for you. I'm grateful for this opportunity. I'm grateful for the opportunity to attend that seminar and to spent the time to figure a little bit more out about Bitcoin the op.
Okay, Harry, you have a wonderful day. Thank you again for joining us on the Solera Report.
Great, and hopefully this was helpful to your subscribers.
Oh, very, very.
Thanks, buddy.
Bye.